Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 235, recorded for the week of November 8th, 2023. Looker for mobile, ruining vacations one notification at a time. Good evening, Ryan, Jonathan, and Matt. Full house tonight.
Woohoo! Hey, guys.
Hello.
For those of you who don't check out our show notes, though, we do brainstorm these titles, and they sort of make sense to the episode. And I know some of you like to play the game of like trying to figure out what our show title meant with what story. But there were so many good ones this week that you definitely want to check out those show notes. But honorable mention, though, I'm going to say it anyways because I liked it so much. The Cloud Pod, breaking news, Microsoft discovers water is wet, AI is worth investing in. That's a good one, too. Fell in a bad thing. And I only mention that because we really also have a new segment this week. We've decided, I've decided because I just told them what we're doing. And they just all agreed and nodded their heads that we needed a place to put AI content that isn't related specifically to cloud services. And so I created a new segment called AI is Going Great as her new segment. And they all agreed with it. So mm-hmm. We're going to have a new section here where we talk about just general AI news things. So there's a lot happening in this space and it's going to be the future of the world, apparently, if you believe the hype. And then if it's around Vertex AI or SageMaker or whatever, I think it's Data AI Studio, whatever Azure has, we'll talk about that specifically related to that cloud provider. And so first up, AI is going great this week with a new study that validates the business value and opportunities of AI and paid for by Microsoft to IDC. To determine what the unique insights of AI and how it's being used to drive economic impact for organizations. They apparently surveyed 2,000 business leaders and decision makers from around the world, where 71% of the respondents say their companies are already using AI, and 22% said they will be using it within 12 months. 92% of the AI deployments, they said, took less than 12 months, which, I mean, when it's as easy as going into Bard and hitting the button, yeah, I've deployed it. Organizations are realizing a return on their AI investment within 14 months, and they're saying for every dollar a company invests in AI, it realizes an average return of 3.5x. And 52% report that the lack of skilled workers is their biggest barrier to implement and scale AI, which I guess that's prompt engineering mostly, or model builders. It's ML, AI has been a problem for years now. And IDC projects that generative AI will add nearly $10 trillion to the global GDP over the next 10 years. And they said the key areas that businesses are finding value is enriching the employee experience, reinventing customer engagement, reshaping business processes, and bending the curve on innovation.
There were some questions that they didn't ask that I wanted them to, like how many respondents are already using AI but wish they weren't? Or, you know, how many months do you think it'll take before they realize how expensive this is? There's a couple of ones in there.
Yeah. How many of you are spending more on AI than you are making in revenue as a company right now?
Yeah.
Surprising number of startups in that space.
Mm-hmm. I was also like looking at it thinking, okay, ChatGPT, which really blew up the market, was what, last November, December, January timeframe, if I can remember. So yeah,
October, November last year.
Yeah. Okay. So you're 1 year approximately to date and it took 12 months or less. Well, obviously the whole thing's only really been really blowing up for the last 12 months. I mean, it's been around for longer than that, but like, really, since it started to hit more mainstream was 6-8 months ago, really, once everyone started using it. So saying it took 12 months when you click a button in a console and you're done feels very strange to me.
Well, that number is going to go up, right? Or it'll average out to be a higher number as, you know, everyone who deploys now is who started forever ago.
I think it's funny that they specifically targeted people who were responsible for making AI-related decisions in the business. So no surprise mm-hmm. that so many companies were already using it because they had a person in that role already. I'm curious about the 7% of people who said they wouldn't be using it.
Well, those are the lawyers they asked.
Yeah. Because
having been dealing with lawyers on AI regulation and AI concerns and the privacy people on AI, like that group is very anti, very mm-hmm. opposed, as well as the actors and the writers apparently in Hollywood are also very opposed to AI for their strikes. But it's definitely interesting that there's 7% of the companies say they're not going to do it. You have to wonder what their business is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder of the $3.50 return on an investment of a dollar, how much of that is actually loss of personnel being replaced by AI rather than improvements in revenue or profit margin?
I don't think there's been enough time, but I mean, it'll come, but it's also sort of like with every advance in technology, there's always a risk of that. And there's always a little bit of turnover with that, but you know, there's also job creation in a lot of these things as well. So it's sort of this weird, it's a hard number to derive.
Yeah.
Well, I was talking about, I think last week while you were gone, or maybe the week before with Ryan or Matt, I don't remember who it was, but we were talking about, I went to this event and they had us use Bard, and you know, the prompt they had us write in was just like, run an interactive tabletop exercise on ransomware attack at my company and include the CEO, CTO, CSO, legal and HR roles in it. And it spit out what I would have paid a consultant $50,000 for to, you know, build this scenario and all that. And then you could, you know, because it was a chat, you could then ask it additional questions like, well, what if the hacker used this? Or what if we decided not to pay the ransom? What would be our steps to recover? And it would give you kind of the next parts of the playbook. So like to do that with a person who specializes in design those type of things, like that's a big savings for a lot of companies who are trying to do these things. And so those are the use cases that I can see have big improvements, because like now I don't have to go hire this company or this person for a lot of money, and that's a big return. But you know, that'll be a question of, does that return last long term? I think is the big question.
Yeah, some people call it cost savings. Other people call it copyright theft from the people who wrote those documents and scenarios in the first place.
Sure.
And I think for now it's going to be great while I've got this training material that people can now generate content with, but it's definitely it's limited in its capability to imagine new scenarios and come up with new ideas. And so I think there'll probably be a bit of a plateau.
Have you ever been to one of those tabletop exercises?
Yes.
It's very limited imagination.
Yes. As you know, like half an hour into the scenario, I was wishing that I'd been one of the victims that the gunman had shot when he came into the building.
So I go the other approach. I attack the scenario and prove how the scenario isn't even a valid scenario and piss off everyone. That's also a fun way.
It's always one.
I lobbied for alien invasion to be the scenario. PCP had alien invasion. I got shut down pretty quickly. I'm like,
that'd be a fun one, though.
It would be. Yeah.
You know, like I think ones I was involved in last time, one was like, you know, before COVID, when we used to be in an office, it was like, you know, a tanker truck turned over in front of the building and there's poisonous gas, you know, coming towards the building. And what do we do? And like, okay. And then one was ransomware, of course, because everyone does a ransomware one. Mm-hmm. And then another one was a virus outbreak of some kind, I don't know, something. But, you know, they're actually really interesting when you do them. Mm-hmm. And so you learn a lot about how much your executives are not prepared for what this reality is.
What's a communications plan?
Yeah, exactly. Which I guess we'll talk about in the after show today. So for those of you in the know, there's an after show after the closing bumper that we'll talk about some of that, because there's been some SEC news in that space that we're going to just chat about. But yeah, it's amazing. Microsoft, thank you for telling us that the business you've invested billions of dollars into is going to be good. Thank you for that. GPT-4 Turbo and custom GPTs were announced this week at the first ever OpenAI developer conference. The best thing about this is the newer data in the GPT-4 Turbo. So no longer will it tell you that Nancy Pelosi is the Speaker of the House. It'll now tell you that Kevin McCarthy was the Speaker, because it's only updated until April, which is still wrong, but not as wrong as it was. So that's a plus. The new GPT-4 Turbo supports 128 contexts, and input-output tokens are 3 to 2x less expensive. And you no longer have to tell OpenAI if you're paying for the subscription. If you'd like to use the GPT 3.5 or the 4.0 or the internet browsing plugins like DALL-E 3, that'll all automatically be detected. So if you're typing to it and you're in the chat and all of a sudden you said, well, create me an image about the thing you just answered to me, it can now make that pivot automatically, which is available to you today if you're a ChatGPT Plus user, which I am now paying them $20 a month. So yes, I am. Thank you. They also announced Copyright Shield, which means OpenAI will defend its customers and pay the costs incurred if they face copyright infringement claims. And OpenAI is launching a platform to develop your own custom version of GPT, which is an evolved version of their ChatGPT plugin capabilities. And OpenAI will also be creating a GPT store to monetize those custom ChatGPT plugins you're creating, so users can create and browse those much easier. And, you know, it's like on the surface to me, this all seems very natural progression of all this, but people on Twitter were like losing their minds, like, oh my God, this is the future of AI. And that's, I'm like, okay, off the Kool-Aid, folks. I don't exactly know what that means yet, but it does look pretty interesting what they're announced, and I'm kind of excited to see it. And I've been playing with that in my playground, which is nice. So, yeah. What do you think, Jonathan? I know you're kind of into this stuff.
I'm looking forward to it. That's something that I'd be really interested in building plugins for. I laughed when I saw a screenshot of the building a custom model cost. Something like made, you know, between $2 and $3 million to customize a model fully, which is quite an expense for a click box in a browser.
Yeah. I mean, there's some cool things. I do like that, you know, there's some clear monetization of this, you know, in these announcements. And so I think that, you know, led to a lot of the hubbub I saw online with, because people are like, it's one thing for cool technology, but if it can actually, you know, make some money, it's likely to be successful and change things. But, you know, like the other thing I thought was interesting is like it really harkened back to the early days of search or internet search in general, just, you know, keeping data up to date. Some of these problems don't go away. And it's sort of interesting how much of those patterns we'll get to sort of re-go through. And it's kind of exciting. So it's kind of neat.
I'm really enjoying the generative search results from Google.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't know if everyone's getting those or not, but I've got this Google opinion rewards thing, and every time I do a search, it pops up a thing and asks me my opinion on the result that it gave. And that stuff is up to date. So mm-hmm. they're either spending an absolute fortune on the back end, constantly retraining or adding data to the model, or something else that we don't know yet. But it's really changed search for me completely. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was thinking for Google, because they're constantly doing that anyways, right? They have all the crawlers that are crawling the internet every day, because that's the only way a search engine makes sense. If you're also feeding that into a GPT model at the same, it can't be that much more expensive for them to plug it into the model. And I'm actually surprised that with GPT-4 Turbo that they didn't say it was going to be a continuous update process where, you know, it'll always be a couple months behind, but you can kind of slowly see it. Because having a major version just be tied to the data relevancy doesn't really make a lot of sense for me for a versioning thing. I kind of expect it to be getting better over time and learning new things. So that is sort of interesting that, you know, that's like they didn't announce more there. I thought that would be something they would announce at their conference, but they did not.
Yeah, I think the way Google must be doing it really is they have models with incredibly large context windows so that they can have the trained model, which has got lots of historical information in, plus an awful lot of information that they pass every time you make a call to the model. And eventually that kind of gets aggregated back kind of into long-term memory in a way. So it's like a short and long-term memory. They must have a batch process that it does that update, because it's very expensive to run models with, you know,
the constant training.
128, 256,000. I mean, and Claude is even bigger than that right now. So that's,
yeah. Well, I was reading some stuff about Meta's Lambda 2. And, you know, people running Lambda 2 in their own private, it's costing them more than it would just cause them to, you know, license it from somebody else. So, yeah, these models are great, but they're expensive. And so, you know, you need to think that stuff through.
Yeah, we didn't mention Twitter's Grok. We could have mentioned that and how terrible that looks.
I forgot about that already. Like, that's,
Yeah, I could have brought that in here, but, you know, So X.com is going to merge with XAI, which apparently is Elon's AI startup thing, but it's going to be Sassy. That's its thing. And I'm
still sounds like a porn site.
Yeah. I'm like, but yeah, they're calling it Grok, which is funny because that's what New Relic calls their AI. So I'm like, that could be a copyright thing.
Yeah.
So that would be sort of interesting, but, yeah, I didn't have a lot of respect for it, so honestly, I forgot about it.
No, it lost me in the press release, and the minute he confused "Stranger in a Strange Land" and "Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy," I was out. Like, yes. Pass. Mm-hmm. Do not conflate these two; they are not the same.
Yeah. Well, and the words like "maximum truth-seeking AI," like what does that mean? yeah, it has real-time access to the X platform, so it should be more up to date than potentially other things. But yeah, there was the thing about it's just like it would, if you tried to ask it to like how to create a heroin at home, it would give you some sarcastic answer back, like, I'm not going to tell you that, you think I'm stupid or something like that. And I'm like, I don't want that tone. Like, no thank you, not from my AI. All right. And then the last story, I don't really have much to say about it, but unlock the repeatable value of your organization with LLM ops, which I can summarize this entire 3,000 word article into: your ML ops team is now your LLM ops team. And you can move along from this one. But makes sense. Yeah.
Yay.
I was like, how did you write so many words on this? Like, so many words. Like, and everything is just stuff that you did in ML.
They use AI to write the words. That's how they wrote so many
words. That's exactly how they did it.
It's just an irresponsible use of tokens.
Yeah.
Have you been waiting months and months to hire a new AWS, GCP, or Azure architect, only to have them be poached at the 11th hour by a startup with a juice bar? Initiative stalled because you're having trouble hiring? Well, I have a simple solution, Foghorn Consulting. Foghorn Consulting provides top-notch cloud engineers to the world's most innovative companies and can be burning down your DevOps and cloud backlogs as soon as next week. Foghorn certified AWS, GCP, and Azure professionals are armed with infrastructure as code and from day one will be designing performant, optimized cloud-native or hybrid environments that deliver on the promise of cloud. Their FogOps solution even provides on-demand cloud engineering to augment your existing teams. Visit www.foghornconsulting.com or send an email to cloudtalentnow@foghornconsulting.com and tell them the CloudPod sent you. Your dedicated FogOps team is with you for the long haul, and they bring their own juice.
All right, let's move on to AWS, because that's all that happened to AI last week that I cared to talk about, at least there. Announcing Finch 1.0 is now generally available. Apparently, this was a year ago that we talked about Finch being their first command line developer tool for building, running, and publishing Linux containers on macOS. And I do think at the time I said, I don't really know what's different about this versus Podman. And I've continued to be very satisfied with Podman, but I did do more research this time because they had a website and they had more articles than we talked about last time. So runfinch.io is the new website for the project. I am a little curious to see if it gets popular, but the big difference between Podman and Finch, Podman is designed to be more multi-platform, and so it uses the CRI-O libraries, where Finch uses Containerd, which of course is Amazon's preferred container runtime, which is why they chose it, as well as Podman uses Qumu for their container runtime environment, where Finch uses Lima, which is more aspect or more fit for macOS in particular because it runs on ARM. And so that's what the differences are. So if you want more Containerd because you're doing ECS or you're doing EKS, Finch may be a better choice for you, versus Podman will be your more generic use it for any different thing. And you can use it on Windows, which is how I reason why I found it first, because I didn't want to pay Docker all that money.
There's a bit of a caveat with Lima for macOS, at least in that they have no CI for ARM-based Macs. And so if you've got an old Mac, it's great. If you've got a new Mac, you're either behind the times or you've got bugs they don't know about. But apart from that, it's pretty good. It's significantly faster than running Docker on Mac. And it integrates nicely with macOS networking for easy port forwarding and things like that. It's very seamless. It's quite good. I installed it today.
Good. Cool. I might check it out now that it's, now that I know what the differences are. Now I actually like, okay, now I actually care. Before I didn't care. It was like Podman was working. I'm very happy. But anyways, Amazon has new ways for you to burn money. This is the new Amazon EC2 capacity blocks for machine learning, a new Amazon EC2 usage model that further democratizes ML by making it easy to access GPU instances to train and deploy ML and generative AI models. With EC2 capacity blocks, you can reserve hundreds of GPUs co-located in an EC2 Ultra cluster designed for high-performant ML workloads using an Elastic Fabric Adapter network and a petabit scale non-blocking network to deliver the best network performance available in Amazon EC2. The innovative new way to schedule GPU where you reserve the capacity for a future date for just the amount of time you need and require, and they are currently available for EC2 P5 instances powered by the NVIDIA H100 Tensor Core GPU only in the Ohio region. They did compare this to a hotel room reservation, like, hey, I know that this weekend I want to go stay at a hotel, and I want a room with either a king-size bed or two twins or whatever, and so you can specify all those things, and then that'll be available to you on that date and that time. I'm okay with the idea of picking a date I want to do it, but to like know when my job is going to end seems suspect, because I've been watching a hackathon happen this week around AI, and people have been building ML models, and they're not super complicated models, and takes hours in some cases. And I'm like, yeah. Well, how would you ever predict how long it's going to take if you don't know? So this is a great idea, but maybe has some limitations unless you really know your model workload.
I think this is more just someone was wanted to train models, had some sort of time crunch, released to market or something, and said, shut up and take my money. And Amazon didn't have a mechanism to take that money. Now they do. So,
yeah, I think it's a sign that the resources are just massively constrained. They must be so busy, and to monetize things properly, to stop people moving off to the clouds, I guess they have this scheduling option now, so you can guarantee availability. But I'm sure there's fees. You know, if you don't stay the extra night, then they may still charge you for it.
Yeah. I was thinking they're charged for the capacity blocks themselves, just the reservation, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I think they are charging for the capacity block. So if you book three days and your job only takes 2 days, you paid for an extra day you didn't use.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. And there's security guards that kick you out 30 minutes before they stand at your door 30 minutes before and kick you out of the hotel room.
Sweet.
I can't wait to get the bill just like slipped into my office door or something. Mini fridge.
Yeah. For CFO hundreds. Eyes only.
Yeah.
Don't look at it. and then our last Amazon story, the Instance Metadata Service version 2 is now becoming the default. Effective mid-2024, newly released EC2 instance types will only use the version 2 of the EC2 Instance Metadata Service. This has actually been the case for a while with some of the new ARM processors. In February 2024, they will create a new API function that will allow you to control the use of the V1 as the default at the account level. So you can now specify it at an account basis. And then IMDS V2 will be the more secure option to access the internal instance metadata and eliminates a potential attack vector in your instance, which if you're still using the V1 and you have sensitive workloads, I'd highly recommend you do this soon. So, you know, this has been a thing for a couple of years now where there's some pretty bad exploits. You know, I got onto the box and now I get access to metadata, which got me access to be able to cross different zones. And this is the idea of this is to prevent that from happening.
No, I think it speaks to how complex this problem was that it took Amazon this long to make that the default, right? Like there's so many things that leverage that service for authentication, and changing it at all would have been really problematic for a lot of customers, I assume, as fast as, you know, I've seen code update. So
yeah, I was going to say, how many scripts out there do you have that still reference it?
Mm-hmm. And they're old style scripts that are still in an S3 bucket from whoever wrote them 17 years ago.
I mean, how much documentation on Amazon's website still gives you the old way?
Yeah, that's probably true too.
GCP's got some stuff for this week. First up, Looker Studio Pro is now available for you on Android and iOS devices. This enables millions of users to bring their data to life with insightful dashboards and visualizations, connecting to more than 1,000 data sources and host a community-sourced set of reports and templates. Looker Studio Pro expands on the self-service business intelligence platform with enterprise capabilities, including team content management and Google Cloud support. And with the Looker Studio Pro for mobile devices, you can enable your users to view reports and get real-time data about your business from anywhere in the world. And my executive self loves this.
This just proves to me that executives don't do any real work. That's all this is.
We don't. We just look at reports.
They're on a beach somewhere on their phone. They're like, yeah, this is red now. Fix it.
Golf course, beach, you know, whatever you want to see. But, you know, they actually did a pretty nice job. If you look at the screenshots in the article we linked to, you know, they made it mobile ready. It's mobile native. It's the right sizes. You can, you know, share views out of it. You can send it, you know, all the good things that you expect to do in a hassle-free manner. So yeah, I need some Looker cost review reports, Ryan. And could you get that so I can get that on my phone or my iPad?
Yeah.
That'd be great.
It's a little bit of inception. It's going to cost you an arm and a leg to subscribe to Looker Pro and generate those reports. And so it's going to actually generate its own report.
I'd be kind of worried about data loss and controlling data loss with something like this. I can't imagine the CISOs are going to be particularly happy with making data available on any device.
I mean, it's not the data itself, it's the presentation of the data.
Well, I suppose right? It depends what's in the report, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, again, if you are using mobile device management or mobile access management, you put the Looker app into that walled garden, and that's how you would basically protect it and say you can't save, you know, images or screenshots from this app into your camera roll. There's ways to do it. But yes, you need to think that stuff through. Google is thrilled to announce the preview release of their very first VM family based on ARM architecture with the Tau T2A, powered by the Ampere Ultra ARM-based processor. T2A VMs delivered exceptional single-threaded performance at a compelling price. These predefined VM shapes are up to 48 vCPUs per VM and 4 gigs of memory per vCPU. They offer up to 32 gigabits of networking bandwidth and a wide range of network-attached storage options, making the Tau T2A VM suitable for scale-out workloads, including web servers, containerized microservices, data logging, processing, media transcoding, and Java applications. And you can now use this right out of the box with Kubernetes Engine and the Batch Engine, or on your own custom workloads on instances. And Jonathan, I'm happy to award you a point for the Google Next conference 3.5 years ago for this finally being delivered.
Yeah, I kind of get that with interest.
Yeah. The worst part is you're going to have to think of something new to guess from the next one.
Well, Slack may still get sold.
Apparently they're getting a new CEO next week. So yeah, who knows? Maybe it's a new CEO and a divestment.
Well, that's cool. Happy to see this announcement finally.
Yes. I'm surprised how long this took, to be honest. Considering how much everyone else is doing with ARM processors these days and Mac and everything, you would have thought this would have been at least a Google Next this year. Even if it's just coming. We're not going to talk about it yet, but it's coming. You would have thought it would have showed up on stage.
Yeah, obviously did.
Vertex AI Search is adding new generative AI capabilities and enterprise-ready features because all products now have to have AI in them. Vertex Search was made generally available in August, which has these new capabilities today around a couple different areas. First of all, new customizations and expanded grounding and compliance capabilities for customers to develop even more powerful and secure search, chat, and personalized recommendation applications. And the new generative AI features address the needs of organizations, especially large enterprises, that want a more deeply customized AI-driven search with customizable answers, search tuning, and DIY search engines with vector search and Vertex AI embeddings. Some of the concerns that enterprises have about generative AI is that they can be prone to hallucinations, which is a fun way to talk about they lie to you. Mm-hmm. And with a new grounding in enterprise data or grounding in selected public data sets, you can help ensure the data is more accurate than ever before.
When I think about training this on internal documentation and the idea of the documentation can lie to you, I'm like, yeah, that's what documentation does. it's out of date 5 minutes after you publish it. What's the difference? It just says it with such authority that, you know, you have more confidence in it versus knowing your wiki is wrong.
If AI said it, it has to be true.
It's true.
I think hallucinations are going to get solved pretty quickly, actually. Because if you think about a person, if I ask, you know, Justin what he knows about RV maintenance, he may know that he knows nothing, and he can say that he knows nothing about it, and he won't just make something up. Mm-hmm. If I ask somebody else, you know, they may make something up. I mean, it's what people do; it's the way people behave. But I think we need to figure out how to train models to know what they don't know, mm-hmm. not just know what they do know.
Hey, I know a lot about RVs. I know they have engines. I know they're really big cars that I don't need a truck license for. And I know they have a black water tank that you must empty. Otherwise, bad things happen. I know that much. So it's not nothing. It's just not authoritative.
So AI models, just like your RV black tank, is full of shit. Nice analogy.
Yes. Thank you.
Very good.
Open that door right up for you. You walk right on through.
It's like you planned to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, I do know Jonathan pretty well, so you know, I know how to tee up a softball for Jonathan. All right. And then Azure is here talking about Focus. Focus is the new specification for cloud cost transparency. I think we have talked about it on the show before, but from the FinOps Foundation perspective. And Azure has a great post about their support in cost management after the Focus 1.0 release ships later this year. I don't think we talked about it when AWS announced it, or I wasn't here that day. But AWS is also now supporting Focus. So that means all three big cloud providers are now going to support the Focus standard, which is a groundbreaking initiative, which is strong words, to define a common format for billing data that empowers organizations to better understand costs and usage patterns and optimize spending and performance across multiple clouds, SaaS applications, and even on-premise service offerings. And there's a quote here from Tim O'Brien, Senior Director of Engineering Cloud Cost Management at Walmart Global Tech. At Walmart, we spend a lot of our time not only normalizing data across different clouds, but we're also constantly reacting to changing SKUs and services in areas like storage, compute, and AI/ML. One of the most significant outcomes of Focus is in just that we are aiming to simplify and standardize on a common specification. It's the conversations that are starting to on best practices. How should we all think about amortization for committed and reserved instances? What are our standard values for service categories? It's much more than just a conversation about a few fields. It's a discussion that will help define best practices and standards for cloud computing market that continues to expand to new areas like SaaS, IoT, and Gen AI. We're discussing standards today that will be foundational for how we talk about costs for decades from now, and it's exciting times. You can also get access to a report, the Microsoft Focus Sample Power BI report, which I'm excited to learn exists because I was just talking to our finance guy and he was saying, Microsoft's Azure billing is horrendous and he hates everything about it.
Yep.
And so I was like, well, this Focus thing might solve part of his problem. So I might go try to figure out how to make this work. Oh, but Matt says no. Okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Well, that wasn't the defense.
It can't hurt. Let's go with that. Yeah. I mean, I would like for them just to agree on the standard of the field columns first. From there, they can go into everything else. But like, let's start with standardizing that at least across the board.
Well, I mean, I'm just excited that we're going to standardize things. Like, are we going to include operating system cost in the hourly rate of an instance like Amazon does? Or are we going to call it out as a separate line item like Google and Azure do? Like, those are like, make it really hard to just simply compare a server to, you know, the different cloud providers. But the other big thing about Focus is that it really does finally commoditize all of the big vendors and cost management. Like, if you're just showing me data, you're just a commodity at this point. You got to show me more than just recommendations. You got to show me way more data. And that, I think, it drives higher value out of those services and tools and makes them justify their 3% of my cloud spend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's going to be the big, I think, shift with this as it gets adopted, is more time will be spent developing on stuff, on different ways to see the cost and different ways to do analysis versus just how much time you spend breaking apart things and trying to make an apples to apples comparison between different values. It's very difficult. So this is fantastic.
I'm hoping we don't lose some information along the way, though, because I mean, I guess the concern for finance is that if the product name changes from month to month, it's a bit more difficult to keep track of spend on a particular thing, particularly instance type, for example. But at the same time, you know, while SRE are optimizing different, you know, different instance types for different services, it's useful them to have that information available in the report to say, look, we're spending this much on this type, this much on this type, and kind of go into more detail. So I hope we don't lose the defined details in this. I hope really it's just a sort of a more of a summary view of cloud costs.
I think we're already losing a bunch just because you can't go deep into a lot of data sets and do an analysis or a comparison between things. And especially over time, as things are already, you know, it's already a matter of changing. It makes it really difficult to just visualize and make a report make sense and draw, like, you know, some statements and some views from it. So it's, I think that there's, you know, are we going to lose some? Probably in some areas, but we'll gain in others. And be that kind of trade-off.
I mean, and you can't lose everything, right? Like, you can't just throw away a cost vector because it's in the bill, right? Your Focus report needs to match up to what your bill is. Otherwise, people are going to not trust it and won't be able to be a thing. So, I mean, it has a common schema, has basically its expectations of what it's going to do. And it's standardized. And it's standardized in a way that's supposed to make it easy to ingest. And so you don't have to build custom connectors for GCP. I mean, one of the problems we have right now is we're looking for a FinOps tool for GCP stuff. And like most of the providers don't really have a FinOps story for GCP because it's the smallest market. You know, as we talked last week in earnings, you know, they're a third rate cloud that needs to make more profit. So, you know, we need to drive, you know, those things. And so it's hard to go talk to a vendor and say, well, hey, we really like to use you, but you don't support GCP. And they're like, yeah, but it's smallest market of the three that we could attack, and we're just not going to attack that market first. But now with a standardized format, yeah, we support standardized Focus import. Maybe we don't do some of the analytics, some of the other fancy stuff, but at least we can show you the data. That's a start in the right direction. Well, that is it for this week's main stories. So have a great week, you guys. We'll see you next week here in the cloud.
See you later.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
And that is the Week in Cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Foghorn Consulting. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and tweet us your feedback at #TheCloudPod. Or join our Slack channel, go to our website, thecloudpod.net, for sign-up instructions. Time for the after show, where you will get a cyber attack, Ryan. You will get a cyber attack, Matt. And Jonathan, you also will get a cyber attack.
But I don't want one.
3 out of 4 of the CoPod hosts got their mortgage lender hacked. So it's been a hug ops kind of month over the last three or four weeks here. And so we thought we'd kind of talk about some big hacks, some big issues that kind of happened in the market and what that's going to mean for the future, because I think there's some interesting regulations that are starting to change out there. So, you know, from a very simplistic perspective, you know, if you are using a mortgage vendor named Mr. Cooper, who has 4.5 million loans, they were hacked. They were cyber attacked, most likely ransomware. They haven't come out and said what it is. They couldn't process payments from Halloween until just yesterday, the 7th of November. And that's pretty bad. They haven't told us if their data was hacked. I can't wait to find out they've got my entire financial history now on the dark web. So can't wait for that to be announced. But you know, I did get access to their system. I did change my password, which I'm sure they'll make me change my password again next week when they catch up to the people who are like me or security conscious. But I've at least made that change. But yeah, so that's bad news. And then, you know, if you're not, if your mortgage isn't one thing, you know, your Okta security might be another one where they were hacked again. Well, not really hacked, but they had another support breach, which is the worst case because that's what happened to them a year ago. But this one, they've apparently now aligned on the fact that one of their support people was using Chrome on his laptop, logged in with his personal credentials in Chrome to synchronize his bookmarks and his porn and all the other things you have in your bookmarks. And that also synchronized his passwords. And so then he went to an Okta website for the support thing, saved his credentials, and then somehow his personal Gmail account was then hacked. And then, of course, he has his Okta credentials sitting there in his Google Chrome password keychain. And they just use that to just jump right into the Okta support system, which apparently doesn't require VPN or anything else to get into. And then using customers' HAR files, they were able to basically get into their systems and attack companies like Cloudflare and others who had notified Okta. Now, that's a pretty sophisticated attack, I would say, from on the surface of what they did. But, you know, again, Okta in Okta's famous fashion just botched all the comms every time. they suck at the comms. Like, we're talking to Sarah, who's been a friend of the show, and she's like, the hack isn't that special. It's nothing crazy. You give them a HAR file with all this data, and Cloudflare actually created a tool. So if you are providing a HAR file with credentials in it, or it, they can actually strip that data out before you provide it to Okta or other companies you need to provide this to, you know, that's a, you know, you're going to get hacked. It's like you gave the keys to the person and those keys were used. That's what happened. But, you know, really, it's how do you respond? How do you acknowledge it? It took them 3 weeks to basically admit there was a problem. Again, third-party support teams, that was a problem the first time around. So Okta's looking pretty bad out there. And then Cloudflare themselves had a major control plane failure on November 2nd in their high ultra cluster data centers, and they threw FlexCentral under the bus for a data center power failure. They have a really good write-up of it, but, you know, it's, again, one of those, is it really the data center's fault, or is it really your fault for not, you know, properly testing your high availability solutions? But they recovered after a few days as well. So, you know, bad week for HugOps in general. Any questions on those three or four issues there? Or thoughts?
I mean, the data center power failure is always like a near and dear to my heart, just because I've lived through that on the, you know.
Oh yeah, that one I'm familiar with. It's the worst
in past, right? So it's just sort of like, ah. And, you know, testing for that kind of failure is really difficult. And it's you can spend as much time engineering that test and that failure response as you can actually developing software. So I mean,
that's why the Yahoo model, where you guys just basically cut all access to a data center as part of your testing of DR, like, it makes sense. Because I mean, basically they talked about in their article that they have this ultra high availability cluster divided across three data centers. And these apps, as they go through an SDLC lifecycle, they get onboarded to the high availability cluster, which works great, except for when you have dependencies on things that aren't in the high availability cluster. Mm-hmm. Oops. And so I think it changes how you think about your SDLC and when do things go into beta access or production access, or if it has a dependency from the ultra cluster to the new service, it has to also meet the same SLA. Otherwise, you run into this problem.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of stinks a little bit of developers who don't think to test their apps with, you know, TLS as they're doing their work, and then that becomes an ops thing. I kind of thought, well, you know, if you're developing applications, you should be doing this with high availability in mind from the beginning. And it kind of seemed like from the RCA that they didn't do that. They built new products, and MVP did not include, you know, HA being part of the HA cluster. So I get those sort of some weirdness with the data center and the questions around, you know, the connectivity to the power grid and things like that. But having said that, they don't have an infinite supply of diesel on site, whatever it is they use to run the generators. There was probably only a day worth of power, if that, available, if the power had gone out. So they still would have had the same problem regardless.
I mean, they typically have contracts to get fuel delivered regularly. Now, in a true natural disaster like Hurricane Katrina, you find out very quickly that those contracts are mean nothing, because getting a fuel truck through, you know, flooded roads is not possible, and so you just can't do that. But in this particular case, where they were just dealing with an issue with the local grid, they would have been able to get at least diesel fuel delivered at some time frame. But again, like, they have a lot of, like, you know, they're mad at Flex Central because Flex Central didn't tell them that they had switched off of one of their feeds had gone down and they had switched to generator power as a backup. I mean, like, that's why you have redundancy. I don't need to know that you're using redundancy unless you think there's going to be a situation where there's more failure mode operations. You know, a very classic thing we're learning is that data centers don't hire engineers to work night shift.
Yeah, that's right. I remember reading that.
I sure have this problem.
Yeah. So I mean, like, that isn't a, you know, yeah, why would I have a really expensive electrical engineer who's going to work 2 to 3 a.m. you know, when these things happen, and they always happen at those times. So, you know, those are things that are going to be an issue that you have to design around. So yeah, it's, you know, again, I think they're blaming it Flex Central. It's kind of a little dirty. Like, you know, you could have just left it at your data center provider, and we're asking these questions of our data center provider. They didn't have to name the vendor, but you know, Cloudflare has been always known for being very, very, very transparent in their post-incident RCAs and what they did and what they learned, and they'll learn from this. And I think you're about to see their SDLC get mature. But, you know, it's interesting you said this is an ops problem. In some ways, that's what SRE is supposed to do, right? You know, we built the application. We now hand it over to SRE. SRE is now implementing the production availability of site reliability. Like, it's, in some models, I could see where that becomes an ops problem still.
Yeah. I mean, if they had received a phone call that said, if we're switching to generator power because of this problem, what would they have done? They didn't have these services available to run in another data center.
Yeah, I mean, they said they would have been more proactive about starting to fail over, you know, to the other two nodes in the high availability cluster. But again, they still would have the dependency when the entire data center went down. They still would have been hosed.
Mm. Still pretty impressive that it was control plane only and all this stuff they have deployed globally, carrying on working just fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, going back to an SDLC thing, like, well, our control plane is not as important as our traffic servicing thing. So it's very possible they had different levels of, you know, rigor you had to meet to get something added to control plane versus added to customer facing traffic flows. That's probably why you see some of these things too. So again, I think it's, you know, you learn the hard way sometimes.
Well, and I wonder, like, if you think about, you know, like, you know, they specifically mentioned their Kafka implementation, and like, I've always wondered, really, is the investment to make sure that is available multi-region, and how complicated that can be, and how much complexity that you're adding having two, you know, sort of event streams. Like, is it worth it in the return? Like, I don't know that even in this case where it was exercised and the data center's down, whether it actually still makes sense. Like, I don't know what contractually and what the hit is monetarily for not being able to make control plane updates. It's not good, obviously, but it's not. But does it offset the cost of all that infrastructure and the team and that complexity over time?
No, quite possibly.
Yeah, I mean, if I have an app that I am trying to do deployments of and I can't remove things from cache that are expired, now I'm having a bad experience to my e-commerce site, I could potentially see that, you know, becoming monetary impacting to them. So it's probably a big deal. Is it a huge deal? Mm-hmm. Not really. Is it, you know, if you'd impacted the ability to deliver actual traffic, yeah, I would have had a different feeling about it.
But yeah, exactly.
Well, but, you know, the interesting thing about these, you know, the security hacks is that this kind of brings us to SolarWinds and the SEC. So the Securities Exchange Commission, or the SEC, has announced charges against Austin-based SolarWinds Corporation and its chief information security officer, Timothy G. Brown, for fraud and internal control failures relating to allegedly known cybersecurity risks and vulnerabilities. The complaint alleges that at least October 2018 initial public offering, the released December 2020 announcement that it was a target of a massive, nearly two-year-long cyber attack dubbed Sunburst, SolarWinds and Brown defrauded investors by overstating SolarWinds' cybersecurity practices and understating its failure to disclose known risks. In its filing with the SEC during this period, SolarWinds allegedly misled investors by disclosing only generic and hypothetical risks at the time when the company and Brown knew of specific deficiencies in SolarWinds' cybersecurity practices, as well as increasingly elevated risks the company faced at the same time. So this is kind of a watershed thing, because I don't recall any time where an SEC has actually reached out and filed a charge against a CISO in this particular situation for what they said in their statements. And typically, if you read these statements, they're very vague in their approach. They're very like, you know, we are at risk of these things, you know, but did he purposely mislead them, or, you know, did he do what everyone else was doing? And then the question that kind of comes out of this too is, if you're a CISO, are you all of a sudden now renegotiating your contract?
Yeah. I would like a raise, please. Yeah.
I'd like a raise, and I would like protections of the company's lawyers in the event that this ever does happen to me. Because, you know, is he personally liable for this, or is he protected by you know, executive privilege at the company and what the executive privilege would cover them for, just like any executive, like a CFO making fraudulent financial or making a financial statement that turned out to be fraudulent later. You know, those are things that companies typically protect you on. If you're in those positions, that's part of your contract and part of the things is the legal protections you have unless you willfully committed fraud. And so again, like it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out over the next, you know, probably years as this case goes to trial, but big deal in cybersecurity.
Yeah, I'll be very interesting in the specifics. It feels like there must have been egregious actions for this response, right? Because you don't really see it, but yeah, you never know. Like maybe it is just sort of the, you know, the loss of detail through the telephone game has led to some statements that, you know, turned out to be untrue and didn't stand up under scrutiny, but could have been with the best of intent said at the time, but also could be the opposite where it's like, you know,
yeah.
It's, well, and like, and you know, the cover up's worse than the crime in that case when you do that. And so it's like,
yeah. So, I mean, they're alleging that, you know, basically what they said publicly didn't match even what internal presentation said. They point to a company engineer doing a presentation in 2018 and shared internally that SolarWinds remote access setup was not very secure and that someone exploiting the vulnerability can basically do whatever without us detecting it until it's too late and could lead to a major reputational financial loss for SolarWinds. So, I mean, like, yeah, if you're going to the CISO and you're telling them this and they're not actioning it, then yeah, that is potentially bad. Like you're doing something illegal for your fiduciary duty to the company. But man, this is also great to get a lot of good security budget. Like, oh, go to the, you know, like I'm aware of these risks that we need to address, Mr. Board member. And like all of a sudden you get a lot of money.
Yep. Yeah. Update your risk registers. That's for sure. Make sure that those are all accounted for and noted down and go chase them down.
I think the requirements are just too loose or too loosely defined to make it easy to implement them in a way. Like there are these very loose controls and we kind of check boxes quite a bit by saying, well, yes, we have antivirus installed everywhere. Is it running? No. You know, there's lots of gray areas. And so I think, I mean, how, what's it look like for a CISO? Assuming this person will lose their job. New CISO going into a company like SolarWinds, what do they have to do? They have to shut the product down because they can't be compliant. Do they get sort of a grace period in which to remediate things? Like, I mean, I think there should be more formality around assessing and remediating risks and, you know, reviewing the company's, you know, external audits. Really, I think it's far too much reliance on internal statements.
Yeah, I mean, he's at least according to his LinkedIn, he's still at SolarWinds, but yeah, I mean. It's one of those interesting questions, right? Because cybersecurity is getting hard. These things get really difficult. And, you know, just like HugOps, right? Like, you know, it's hard to run SaaS services at scale and the complexity that we're getting into in Kubernetes. And, you know, Ryan and I were just talking about like how hard Kubernetes could be, you know, and bad implementations of it. And it's like, yeah, you know, it's so much abstraction from the actual root of it. And like, how do you know that every flow is protected? How do you know that every connection is meeting the requirements? Like there's, the job is getting very, very difficult. And if you're going to now be legally liable for what you say and what you do or don't do, like that, the risk suddenly becomes very high for a CISO.
I hope it's a good thing, honestly. I hope there's a lot more transparency out of businesses in their real security postures and that it drives some real improvements.
Yeah, but again, it goes back to, you know, our system isn't secure. Do we shut the business down? Because that's not good for the fiduciary shareholders either.
Nope.
And it takes time to do these things. So, yeah, it's really interesting to see kind of where this heads. But, yeah, we'll keep an eye on it and we'll report back as we see new things happen in that space. But, yeah, I'm glad I'm not a CISO. I don't want that liability.
Yeah. Like, it's hard enough to try, right, to keep things secure. I can't imagine having this all over your head. Like, you're already a target for being fired and being a scapegoat. Now it's...
And you might be thrown in jail for lying to the SEC. Great. Or fined lots of money too.
How's it compared to like the CFO requirements though? Like where the CFO has to sign off on the books.
Well, that's where, you know, SOX comes into play. And so maybe there's a new regulation framework that comes together around cybersecurity. You know, that's a possible outcome of these things, you know, depending on what the legislature does. But they can't do anything right now because they're too busy arguing with each other about silly things. So unlike Dodd-Frank, which was, you know, very much in the moment of the crisis of housing that, you know, they all of a sudden came up with fiduciary responsibility laws and regulations. So it might happen and probably should happen, but when and how is the question.
Yeah. I mean, going back to OpenAI, maybe Nancy Pelosi would be a better Speaker of the House.
No comment. Stay away from the politics, Jonathan.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you guys next week. Hopefully not after a security breach.
Yes, indeed.